Hi, I'm Taylor Romans.
And I'm Matthew Burritt. And this is Hard Beeswax, Experiences in Waldorf Education.
This week on Hard Beeswax, Matthew and I speak with Shell Froelich Deschern, a Waldorf homeschool mom and experienced public school teacher.
If you are enjoying the work that we are doing here on the Hard Beeswax podcast, please consider making a financial contribution on our Patreon account, which can be found on our website, hardbeeswax.transistor.fm.
If a financial contribution is not in the cards for you, please share our episodes with friends, family, neighbors, or any others who you think might enjoy our show. We thank you all for listening.
We are individuals who are part of this global educational movement, and we want to be clear that we are only speaking from our own experiences and impressions. We do not presume to speak for the Waldorf movement as a whole.
Shell, it's lovely to welcome you here to Hard Beeswax. You are yet another person who has come out of the woodwork and reached out to us, which is so exciting.
Yeah,
for both Matthew and myself. We love getting to know new people. And something that really stood out to me about your story is the fact that you have two high school age daughters, one who is almost at the end of, you know, the 14-year kind of traditional educational journey, and it's all been through homeschooling. And homeschooling through the Waldorf lens. And so, first of all, welcome. We're so happy you're here.
Yes, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here and to put faces to voices. I love your podcast. I think it's just stellar. It's one of the best I've heard. And I appreciate all your wisdom and your stories.
So what does Hard Beeswax mean for you?
Well, it's funny because in our Waldorf homeschooling younger days, it was definitely like, wait, we're supposed to do what with this? Like, seriously?
Yeah.
And they did pretty well, these girls of mine, with getting it like, you know, how can we get this soft and what can we do with it? And I think in our kitchen, I should have brought it, but I didn't. I'm pretty sure somewhere in our kitchen is still a beeswax sculpture of Freya when we were doing the Norse myth.
Oh, cool.
It's like, make your favorite, you know, Norse god or goddess. And here's Freya in all her like golden haired yellow beeswax glory. And I'm like, you go, girls. That is like next level. You can do that. So,
that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah,
so maybe just to go back in time, could you share what, as a child, you remember about your experience of education?
Absolutely. So I am a public school girl through and through. I went from, you know, kindergarten through 12th grade, and I grew up in Connecticut, and the school I went to was fabulous. So I just, you know, I had a great experience. And I think being a kid I graduated in 1995, so there's that. But like growing up when I did, it was different. There wasn't such a focus on all this like high stakes testing. There wasn't a focus on like more. I absolutely remember AP classes being solidly senior year, maybe even a little bit in junior year. But now they're like happening in freshman year, which I think is crazy. And so it was, I had a good experience. I would not want to go back to high school. I'm good. We checked that off the list, and I loved my teachers and I loved learning. And so I always knew from the time I was a little girl, I wanted to be two things. I wanted to be a mom and I wanted to be a teacher.
Hmm.
And I think in my brain, I wanted to be a teacher, like in a one room schoolhouse, like, which exists very sporadically, but it's not the norm.
You're like farther down the road.
Yes.
They're still paved. We got to go farther.
Somewhere. I know, like something. It has
little
to
house
be.
On the prairie.
And yeah. So, absolutely. Right. Like, let's just be Laura Ingalls Wilder and all those people. But, I went to the University of Hartford. I was an elementary and special education major there. I had an amazing time. The professors were wonderful. My field work was stellar. Like, I just really enjoyed all of it. And I loved crafting beautiful lessons. But the one thing you don't really learn as an undergrad education major is that your beautiful lessons are not the only thing you're going to be doing in the school world. And there's a whole like business of education, as I like to call it. And it's that's taking more and more center stage. Mm-hmm. But after I graduated, I got a job teaching at the New England Center for Children here in Southborough, Massachusetts. And I got to hone my skills as a special educator. And that was a little more one-room schoolhousey for me. So like, I'm like, here we are. Like everybody's kind of, you know, it was a very much a team teaching approach. And we had just incredible facilities there and educators and specialists and all of it working with kids primarily with autism. And then after I graduated with my master's from Simmons College in Boston, I landed a job teaching in the Hudson Public Schools and truly got to live my one-room schoolhouse dreams, because as a special education teacher with children in a substantially separate classroom, it really was like we were in a one-room schoolhouse. I had kids from age 3 all the way until they went to middle school. So, and I had a lot of freedom because there isn't a set curriculum that works for all of the students that were on my caseload. I had kids with Down syndrome. I might have had kids that didn't quite have their autism diagnosis yet. I had one little boy who was like profoundly deaf, and he ended up going off to one of the schools for the deaf in the area. But so it really was, and I had a wonderful teaching staff. And so we had a lovely classroom atmosphere and largely could run it the way we wanted. But the more I'm teaching and the more like the state testing is becoming predominant and so like center stage, the more I'm realizing this is not aligning with what I view, you know, childhood and education and teachers and learning and all of that. It didn't align with my educational philosophy. So I probably was destined to be a homeschooling mom even before I knew what that was. And then when I was, when I had my first daughter, Grace, she'll turn 18 this July. So she's in her junior year. Ooh, crazy. But when I had her, I remember thinking, I'm not going to want to hand her over at 5 years old. Like, I'm not going to be ready. It took us a long time to get pregnant with her. And so I think there was like a level of like just wanting, you know, to have as much time with her as I could before we launched her into the world. And she wasn't a kid, like as she got older, she wasn't a child who was like, I want to go to school. I want to ride the bus. Like, I think she really liked her childhood and her life. And her sister came along roughly 18 months later. And it was kind of the same thing. They were like two halves of the same soul and just really enjoyed their days and exploring and learning. And so we naturally like came to being a Waldorf family. I remember learning briefly, like maybe 2 sentences about Waldorf when I was an undergrad, when we talked about alternative educational philosophies, right?
There's like, there's the Montessori's and the Waldorf.
Yep. And then Reggio.
Reggio Mamilia.
Yeah.
I know. I think they had maybe a sentence, right? Yeah. It was like, yeah, but we were being trained to be public school teachers.
Yes,
so it was like, there are these other things, but you're public school teachers.
Yeah.
Like, that's
what
we're teaching you to be.
Right.
And so I didn't really put any stock in it. And then I like Googled one night. I don't even know what I Googled. And I happened upon like, you know, this world of homeschooling that wasn't just people in long denim jumpers and, you know, winning spelling bees, that there were like other ways to do this. And I thought, I could do that. Like, we could have a lot of fun with that.
Yeah.
So
did you use a particular program, or how did you get to Waldorf homeschooling in particular? Because there are these other streams as well.
So, you know, it always starts with the toys, right? Let's be honest.
Hearthsong, Bella Luna.
Yep. Magic Cabin.
They
were hand-drawn back then. Remember Magic Cabin? Like, that arrived in the mailbox, and I was like, what is this beautiful magazine catalog thing? And so I realized, like, as I'm looking, trying to figure out what we're going to do when they're approaching like 5 years old, 6 years old, I was like, what? We just a lot, like so much of what we did just naturally just aligned with the Waldorf philosophy. And so then I started digging into that, and I'm like, well, what's out there? What are the options? And so the first one that's not so Waldorf anymore that popped up was Oak Meadow out of Vermont.
Oak Meadow,
Their curriculum. And they've changed over the years. Like when the girls were really young, it was, and especially if it was like K through third grade curriculum that they had, was more kind of Waldorf than it has morphed into. But it was a nice... like a foundation, you know, yeah. I really took, because I had been a teacher and a special ed teacher at that, I was used to taking from different resources and making them my own.
Yeah.
And so for me, it wasn't so much about we need to have a set curriculum and it needs to be this. It was like, well, what is right for them now? And what do they need to know now? And what are they interested in now? And how can we just like layer it and just build this really solid foundation for them for when they're ready to really launch into, you know, more serious academics. Mm-hmm. And just creating these days where they were always learning. Like everybody says that, oh, we're always learning. But like legit, we were always learning. So it was like, you know, we were baking, we were going outside, we were like taking nature walks, we were reading great stories and going to the library, like all the, it was just so rich, you know? Mm-hmm. And so as they got more towards seven, it was like, okay, well, what are we going to use for this academic piece? And so Oak Meadow was great. I really liked them for kindergarten and first grade, kind of that laying the foundation of the letters and the stories that go with them. But then for my two, it ended up like really ramping up in like second, third grade. And I was like, oh, this is too fast. Like yeah. we need to slow this down.
Hmm.
So then I went back on the internet to see what else people were using. And there were, you know, there was Christophorus, which I'm not sure that they're around anymore. And there was Waldorf Essentials that Melissa Nielsen and her husband created. And so that one is what we use for the next handful of years. But again, it was just kind of like the foundation and we ran with it. I would always say to them, what do you want to learn? What are you interested in? And we'd kind of go from there. And so, but it was always like, I mean, we have stacks of main lesson books in my closet. I'm like, what am I going to do with all these main lesson books?
You're going to keep them until your children are in their 30s. And then you're going to drop them off on their doorstep and say, you keep these now.
Here, children, take them all. Yeah, there's like, I just cleaned out from the shelf over there. I'm like, here's some that we don't need anymore. But, it's incredible. And just, I think it was like, it spoke to their soul. And it really, really captured who they were and what their strengths were. And it's also given them skills and knowledge that I did not acquire through my public school years. Like I've relearned things with them, you know.
I'm wondering, you know, going back to those early days where, you know, when you have a young child at home, you know, you kind of stumble into rhythm because you're just, you have to, right? Even if it's just like we eat lunch before nap, right? There are just rhythms that kind of eventually settle into place. So then I'm wondering for you as a parent and then also shifting into this role of parent educator, then when you transition to maybe, okay, we're going to start actively doing this homeschooling thing, what did that actually look like in those early years within the rhythm of your day? Or was there much of a deviation away from how you had been living and doing things?
Yes and no. And I will also say that the rhythm remains today, which is hysterical to me. And I love rhythm versus schedule.
Yes.
I love, it's like really that in-breath and the out-breath and like, it's not so time-based and people are like, I don't understand. And I'm like, it's like the naturalness of your day, right? They would wake up, we would have like our early kind of morning, whatever, little chats, snuggles, whatever they wanted to do, maybe some Little Bear. And it was like, it went from that kind of quiet flow, wake up into breakfast. And then from breakfast, it went into, you know, getting dressed and ready for the day. And then from that, we would move into our morning meeting. And that really grew as they grew, right? Mm-hmm. When they were young, it was like a verse and a song and whatever the theme was for that, you know, like apples in September, we're reading books about apples. And, you know, and then from there, we might depending on the age, it was like either there was main lesson work or there was, we were going on and everything was an adventure.
Yes.
Oh, we're going to go on an adventure today, right? Or like we went outside or we baked something and it just, and then it went to lunch. And then after lunch was everybody's favorite quiet time. And then after quiet time, it was the afternoon. And the afternoon was a little more free form. And as they've gotten older, it's gotten filled in with dance classes or whatever. Mm-hmm. But they've always, it's just been kind of this beautiful flow to our days.
Yeah.
And there was 2 years, last school year and the year before, where they were actually at a public charter school, which was not ultimately a good fit for them. And we could see them wilt because it wasn't about the flow,
yeah.
right? It was about, now you have to go to math. Now you
yes.
have to go here. And it wasn't so much what, you know, how they could pace themselves. They're very mm. like self-directed at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were really kind of struggling with that, the expectations of a public charter school that was not Waldorf. I think they would have probably thrived at high mowing.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. we did at one point give them the option to, you know, be a boarding student high mowing and come back on the weekends.
Yeah.
They didn't want to be away from home.
Yeah.
Like mm-hmm. yet. So we appreciate that. And that's about, so for us, Waldorf School, Lexington's like 45 minutes one way, high mowing's 45 minutes another way.
Got
we're kind of central.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make sense for them to be day students if they were going to New Hampshire.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
How close is the Hadley Waldorf School?
Oh, that's even a little bit farther.
Oh, okay, gotcha, gotcha.
That's more like, that's like in the, like out toward the Berkshires.
Oh, gotcha, gotcha.
You know, they could have gone there, but that would absolutely be boarding. So I think they would have done well in that kind of setting
yeah.
where it was more
yeah.
familiar.
My question, yeah. I have a couple, but one of them is, how did you find like the socializing aspect of, you know, when you did homeschooling? A lot of families yeah. that I've talked to, they're always mostly worried about, you know, the social aspect, and mm-hmm. they can do the lessons at home, but then, yeah. So what was that like for you?
That we had to make a really concerted effort not to over socialize.
Mm.
So it was, there are so many options. I think we're really lucky here in where we are in Massachusetts, where there are a lot of options for homeschoolers and it's almost overwhelming. Like if you are more of an unschooler and you just are doing all the things, it's probably easier.
Yeah.
But for those of us where there are like, there is some lesson structure to the day, it's, you have to be really cognizant, not take on too much. What is a little trickier. So there's lots and lots and lots of opportunities when you've got these, like, you know, little ones on to maybe early middle school.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets a little trickier because so many people end up with children attending high school, later middle school or high school years. And so what do the teenagers do? But for my two, it's never been an issue. They've always had their dance friends. We attend a UCC church, which is pretty chill, very aligned with Waldorf in a lot of ways. And so they have, like, you know, their friends there. They're part of a Girl Scout troop. Like, it's just, there's so much. These are not your, like, we like to joke, oh, they're so, these unsocialized homeschoolers, and they're, like, the farthest thing from it. But yeah, so there's lots of opportunities. My older daughter, Grace, is a junior intern at Old Sturbridge Village, which is a really cool experience. It's like a village out in Sturbridge, Massachusetts, that's set solidly in the 1830s.
Oh, cool.
And so for the last few years, she's been, you know, junior interning there and learning all about that time period and interacting with the guests that attend and really just kind of making a name for herself there. They both are ski instructors at our local mountain. So, like, it's for them, it's been good. And they are extroverts when they need to be, but they're predominantly introverts.
Mm-hmm.
And so they love to be able to have that time to, like, come back from the people-y world and, like, decompress.
Yeah.
Which I think when they were in school, it was, like, it was just too people-y. Like, they made great friends and they had good experiences in general. But I think just who they are needs that chance to, you know, have some downtime throughout the day where they're like doing their own thing.
Yeah. So. And it sounds too that you definitely held some expectations from your experience as a teacher already. You know, that seems like a gift that you were able to give your children, the sense that you knew how to plan a lesson structure, and you probably provided more structure than some other homeschooling families, perhaps. Could you talk a little bit about what your expectations were and are? And I mean, is college in the future, or is there, I mean, how do you start to integrate, or is that just, you know, totally up to them?
So I will say that oftentimes being an educator has been an occupational hazard. My friend Sharon, who is a teacher out in the public schools out near Boston, she was my sounding board on many a freak out where I'm like, I am ruining them. And she's like, you're not ruining them.
Yeah.
Like, you're fine. And there was at least once a year where I always sit there going, oh my gosh, they're like, what have I done? And it's like, hold on, wait, take a breath. We chose to homeschool because we wanted them to come to whatever in their, when they're ready. Mm-hmm. And so I knew so much about what, you know, was expected in each grade level, but that's not necessarily what I, as an educator, felt was developmentally appropriate. So I had to like rein myself in when maybe it was taking them a little longer to learn to like read, write, spell, you know, but it happened. But if they were, you know, like in the schools from the time they were five, it would have been like pushed and pushed and pushed, and it would have been a struggle and tear filled and all of it. So, so there's that is the first thing. And I think for me, I just knew that if any teacher could create a school day, rhythm, flow, environment, that it wouldn't be what we're all held to, that it would be different, right? And you'd be able to embrace those teachable moments. And that's what we were doing here, was living. Everybody gets into the field for the exact right reason. They love kids. They love learning. They want to instill a love of learning in their students. But more and more their hands are tied and they're not able to just embrace those teachable moments and say, oh, look, today we're just going to get lost in this topic. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we all want to do. Like, that's what we're crafting as undergrads with those beautiful lessons, you know? Mm. And so it was really being able to live that true, like truly live my beliefs as an educator and give my daughters the educational experience I wish all children had. Mm. Having said that, there's definitely times where it's like, oh my word, what have I done? Now that they're getting older, we've definitely been talking more and more about what's next. Mm-hmm. What do you want to do? What are your goals? What's your life work? Like, I'm always telling them that their daddy and I, like, our goal is to launch like these really capable, caring, compassionate, contributing adults into the world. Mm. And so it doesn't matter if you go to MIT or if you choose to like go in and be an EMT. Mm-hmm. Like, we want you to choose what is going to fulfill you and make you happy. And so Grace has started to look at schools and really consider, does she want to go to college? If she wants to go to college, what does she want to do? She's very, very down to earth in regard that she doesn't want to just come out $200,000 in debt for no reason.
Yeah.
So I believe that her current plan is, so she should be done with all her classes and everything. All her high school career should end in 2025.
Yeah.
And I think the plan is that she's going to essentially take a gap year and go to cosmetology school. She has a real interest in hair and makeup, and learn those skills, and then perhaps go on to college later on. And then not only will she have a discernible skill, but she'll have had a year to kind of just figure out what she wants to do.
Yeah.
My younger daughter, Emma, who turns 16 a week from today, she's a little less sure about what she wants to do. And that's okay. She's only 16. She's in her sophomore year. Like, you know, she's got time. But they are also very aware that they want to, they don't want to come, they don't want to like start their adult lives so in debt that they can't
yes.
do things. And they want to be able to like buy a house and they want to be able to, you know, like mm-hmm. do that kind of stuff. And there's like such a big question. Will Gen Z kids even be able to do that?
Yeah, totally.
So, and it's really up to them. If they want to go and do the four-year college thing, then, you know, we will help them figure out how to do that in the most cost-effective way possible. You know, it's interesting to see where it goes. But
totally. That's a, it's a tough question. I think that even those of us in a very, you know, in a more traditional school setting, we're yeah. helping kids navigate as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm so curious about you as a teacher. You know, you come out with a skill set. And then I think sometimes when teachers come to hear what is expected of them as Waldorf educators, they say, oh, okay, this is kind of stretching maybe into yeah. some realms I didn't necessarily think I would have as a general education teacher.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what that was like for you personally? You know, maybe expanding into music, the artwork, the, you know, movement. I mean, what were some of the things that you, and what was that experience like for you? Kind of maybe stretching a little or sure. broadening a little bit to try and, you know, hit all of those rich pieces of the Waldorf indications.
Absolutely. It's hard. It's like, I did consider at one point, should I go back to school? Should I get a master's in Waldorf education? What would that look like? Because I've already got 2 degrees in education. Like how would this work? And at the end of the day, I didn't end up returning to become a Waldorf class teacher because, well, Keene is not that far. Back in the day when the girls were young, everything was in person. I'm like, there's no way I can be up yeah. there for class like yep. all the time. And then to do student teaching, it would probably have me out in Lexington. So, and I realized that my teacher preparation from undergrad and graduate school didn't necessarily translate into Waldorf teacher preparation program. Mm-hmm. Because it is so different, right? Like, as an undergrad for me, there was a lot of theory, there was this, there was that, but there was, it was very much, they were preparing us to be public school teachers. So there wasn't this, here's, you know, let's discuss holding space for the students. Like, there isn't that, you know, mm-hmm. there isn't that you as an elementary school teacher need to be versed in grades 1 through 8 and yeah. that you're going to travel with these kids the whole time. I mean, for me as a special ed teacher, I did travel with yes. my students when they aged out. So I had that similarity, but because my classroom was such a mix of different students with disabilities and we didn't have a curriculum that we were like universally using, like I was creating things for each child.
Yeah.
It was different, right? But I don't feel like I necessarily came out of my undergrad or graduate education knowing how to teach somebody to read or knowing how to teach math. Like we did a lot of discussion, we created a lot of lessons, we did fieldwork experience, student teaching experiences, all very wonderful and well and good. But it was just very surface level, where I think Waldorf educators go way deeper mm-hmm. and they really have the, this like, you know, different connection to their students because they are together for so many years and they are doing this inner work to be able to work with their students better. So as a mom, that kind of came naturally.
Yeah.
But there were definitely things like that. I mean, as a public school teacher, I didn't need to know how to play the recorder or I didn't need yeah, to right. know how to, you know, like do all these other things. So I was essentially like learning from either other people or YouTube or yeah. right along with the girls. Like I didn't know how to knit or crochet. Like I had a little bit of an idea about crocheting, but like I wasn't very, you know, handwork wasn't in my realm because that wasn't something I was taught to do. And And music, I wasn't a music educator, so I didn't really know. I mean, I used to play the flute badly, but like, I, you know, that had been years. I'm like, oh, I had to remember how to read music.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it was, there was a lot of work that I had to do so that I could bring the information and the skills to my girls.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And therefore I was able to learn things that I hadn't learned before or relearn things in a way that actually made more sense than when I learned them as a student myself. So it was challenging. And there were times that I'm like, I can't figure that out.
Yeah.
And I would put it aside, you know, and maybe come back to it later, or I would have one of them figure it out. I don't know where my children's artistic abilities came from, especially my oldest daughter, who can, like, she drew this like beautiful George Washington in the eighth grade. And I'm like, who taught you that?
Yeah.
You know, like, she's always kind of had that innate ability. And she's been allowed to nurture it and really, you know, develop it. And they're just very creative thinkers. And I think a lot of that is because, you know, we came to this world so naturally, but they also had just copious amounts of time to really spend on developing those skills that wouldn't have happened otherwise. So I don't know if I've answered the question.
No, I think you have.
But
yeah,
yeah,
it's just a lot of just natural, it just happened naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And I say all the time, I wish I knew about Waldorf when I was an undergrad.
Yeah.
I wish there was an undergraduate program. I've shared this with Torin.
Yeah.
I'm like, we need an undergraduate program at Antioch, because I would have been all over that if I had known more than two sentences about it.
And yes.
Right.
It would have been amazing.
I'm wondering about if you've had any particular challenges with your daughters being their teacher and their mom. Was there times when, you know, was it a challenge at any, or was it always pretty free flowing and stuff?
I mean, I'm not going to lie. The three of us are a good trio. So it's on the whole, it's been a good experience, but the reading, like coming to reading, especially with my oldest, I should have called her in here to tell the story, but she was like, I don't know. Let's say she was like 8 years old. And we're at the kitchen table working on something, and I'm trying to get her to read something. And there was no way. This was not happening.
Yeah.
She was like, I'm not doing this, woman. We can take all day. And I was like, oh, we can take all day. Like, I've got all day, and so do you. And so, that was one time where, like, we're very similar in that regard, where she's like,
yeah.
No, ma'am. No, I'm not doing this right now. It's not happening. And I'm going to wait you out. And it was like, that was one of those struggles where it was usually around reading and me freaking out, because I'm thinking all her friends are reading and she's not reading. And what is this about? And am I missing something? And I'm looking at her through the lens of that of a special educator. And I'm like, she's not hitting, like, she doesn't have enough of the, like, markers of certain things where I'm like, no, I don't think that's it. I think she's just coming to it really slowly.
Yeah.
Mm. Her dad has severe dyslexia, so it was always on my radar.
Yeah.
That there might be something going on with her. And while I do think that language, written language, has always been tricky for her, she never, like, met any you know, there wasn't like a solid, yes, she's dyslexic. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't like that. It's more like a language-based learning disability, if you need to quantify it. And while homeschoolers are always able to access their school districts for testing and IEPs and services, as a special educator twice over, it was like, there's nothing that the district can offer that we can't do here.
Yes.
Right? Like, so essentially, my children have always had an IEP in regard to being homeschoolers, because it is so individual. Yeah. Right?
Right.
And
right.
So, like, they were always making progress. If you were to have evaluated them,
maybe.
I don't know if you would get if you would get results that you could really compare to their traditionally educated public school peers because the knowledge and the way it's acquired is different. Like,
yeah,
their body of knowledge is different than that of their friends, right? So
was there some kind of public school standard or something that you had to show, or was it purely of your own creation, what the goals were for a particular year?
Or something? So in Massachusetts, we submit like a letter of intent or a homeschool ed plan. It's kind of got a couple different names. People use them interchangeably. It's really where you're laying out to the district, these are the topics we're going to cover. We're going to meet or exceed the 900 to 990 educational hours of the public school year, which is easily acquired because our whole, like the whole 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year counts for us. So like you meet those, that hour requirement pretty easily. And then you also share with them how you're going to demonstrate progress. So for me, it was always, I would write a narrative progress report about each girl in each area that was mentioned in their plan for that year. But as a former special ed teacher, I was always very careful to be generic because we were always taught that if you put it in the IEP, if you name a curriculum in the IEP, you have to use that curriculum or you have to meet and amend to change it. And so for me, I just treated it as we're working on reading.
Yes.
And they will have access to these materials. And then in my narrative progress report, I would say, you know, they read these books, they spell like, you know, they're able to spell 100% of their spelling word, like whatever it was. So I would quantify it in a way that, you know, was easily looked at and said, okay, yes, they're making progress. They're doing these things. This is what they're capable of doing. Some people might choose to have standardized testing done or, you know, something else. It's really up to each family to figure out the way they're going to show progress. But beyond that, it's really like pretty easy to homeschool in Massachusetts. Like there, some states will send evaluators in to kind of look at your portfolio if you do that, or some states do require their state testing to be conducted so that they can like see that the student is making progress. And then there's some states that you don't even have to let the district know you're homeschooling. You don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
So I've been very happy with Massachusetts. Our public school district, Marlborough, is very homeschool friendly, very supportive. There are homeschoolers who've been on the sports teams or participated in other like extracurriculars. The girls have not gone that route because they're busy with dance or riding or, you know, whatever. Like they haven't felt like they want to do that. But if they did, Marlborough would absolutely welcome them and that would be great. So we're lucky in that sense that it's, you know, it's like what I would do for my own students when I was writing narrative progress reports for my the kids on my caseload. So yeah, it's good. They are enrolled at the North Atlantic Regional High School out of Maine, where we will be sending their work, like all their, I've got, you know, Maine lesson books here that I need to grade.
Yeah.
And we'll send that up to NARS and they have an advisor there. And then what the North Atlantic Regional High School does is evaluate this, create a transcript from it. And then once they hit the required number of credits, they'll issue a high school diploma.
Oh,
so
nice.
They're going to come out with a diploma. They'll live in Massachusetts. They're graduating from Maine.
Yeah, interesting.
So yeah, we decided to do that. We just wanted, I don't like to reinvent the wheel if I don't have to. And I didn't really want to dive into creating my own transcript. So we went that route. It's been a great experience so far. And they're loving it. And they, you know, like things like Grace's junior internship at Old Sturbridge Village counts as like a history credit. And Emma volunteered to help a younger group of Daisy Scouts. And that's going to be like community service credit. So they've got like a really rich transcript that's being built. And their years at the charter school, we sent those transcripts and NARS transferred that over. So all that stuff counts.
What if you, I wonder if you could like look back and think back, and maybe are there some things you wish you knew at the beginning, or, you know, advice you would give to your, you know, your younger self embarking on this homeschooling journey? Because I think that, again, I mentioned right when we started the podcast today that I think that this is one of the areas where Waldorf education is probably growing and cultivating most rapidly is mm-hmm. in the homeschooling realm, just because yep. of the financial reality, especially here in the United States, of the cost of much of private school education, and a lot of people who look at the current state of the public schools, and, you know, depending on what state you're in, it may be concerns around the, you know, how political curriculum has become,
right.
or maybe, you know, the exclusion of certain time periods in history, whatever those things
right.
may be, people are stepping away and saying, no, I think I want to educate my children in my home, but I want to look outward to find some tools for doing that. So maybe yeah. what that was a very long-winded way of asking, you know, what would you do? What would you
recommend
or look back and advise someone just starting with all of this?
Oh, goodness. I mean, there's so much out there on the internet. It can be overwhelming. So that's like an incredible resource that we have. My mom always says, oh, I wish I had like it, even half of what you all have, like just the information, the access to information that quickly and easily. So I think, you know, searching online to see what is in your town, in your state, what the like groups and opportunities and resources are that are out there, and connecting, trying to find a group to connect with. When we were just starting out, there was a group, like Yahoo Groups was like a big thing back then.
Yeah.
And so I found a local like group of Waldorf homeschooling families. It was like Under the Willow Tree. How beautiful is that, right?
Yeah.
And they would have like different times that we would gather and for different festival celebrations, and those were things that I was like, what is this Michaelmas we're talking about?
Yeah.
You know, like when we first started. And so it was great to be able to gather with people and learn from other people and, you know, just take what felt right and leave the rest. Like if it didn't feel right to you intrinsically, don't do it. You know, for us, being a Waldorf homeschool family is absolutely right for us. And there's certain things that maybe we don't do that other people do. We did allow media when the girls were young, not excessive amounts. But, you know, Little Bear was a favorite and that felt right to us for them. And we did, they were some of the last to get cell phones. Like, and the only reason my oldest got her phone was because the pandemic started and we couldn't go into the dance studio to retrieve them.
Yeah.
We had been doing that because our whole thing was, we're always together. You don't need a phone.
Yeah.
And we care more about your mental health than anything else. Right. And so, and then now Emma has one, and if I could go back in time, we would have waited till she was 16.
yeah.
You know, it was like, we might have caved a little bit on that one a little sooner than we should have, but it's really, you know, just be true to what you feel is right for you and your children and your family, and try to find other resources. You know, the library's great, the internet. I mean, it's a little dicey in the internet, but you can get a lot of information there. Connect maybe with a local Waldorf school, see if they have, you know, resources that they can recommend, or are homeschoolers allowed to attend their festival celebrations. You know, it's really just being an advocate for yourself and your children. And I think it was just, and knowing that was right. Like, we were almost a little bit of an anomaly initially, because people were like, well, why, there's such great schools in the area, why wouldn't you go? And I'm like, well, if they want to go, they can go. But right now they're really happy being home yeah. and like having the freedom that they have. And, you know, so it's so funny. Like, it's, we don't live in an area where there are bad schools, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like people move to these towns for the schools, and then they're like, why aren't you doing that? Like, as if it's us judging them. Yes. And it's like, no,
yeah,
you know, like it's what I as an educator believe is not what's happening in the schools. And if I could go to the USDOE and like shake things up for the whole country, I would.
Yeah.
But I can't. I can do that for my own too, and maybe inspire other families to have the confidence to try it and see if it works for them. So,
yeah, I'm wondering, to loop back around when you were talking about a very Waldorf idea, which is, you know, meeting the developmental needs of the students at the different ages. You know, that's something for me personally. I'd spent a lot of time learning about what that means, you know, the developmental stages and how to interact with that. What was your personal experience of going from the earlier years and then maybe switching more towards middle school or something? I mean, can you talk a little bit about your personal journey with child development and the stages of development and how you felt yourself maybe change or respond to that?
Oh, that's such a good question. And that could be a whole podcast episode. Oh, my word. It's hard. It's hard. I know you two have younger children, and it's like you're just starting this journey. And we're in uncharted territory because it's so different than how we grew up.
Mm-hmm.
Like just the access to information, the constant amount of devices and screens, and it's just so different. And so we don't have anybody that came before us, although I guess in a way, like I would have come before you too and like could be a resource, but it's like there's nobody before us. So this like Gen Z crew, we're winging it here, people.
Yeah.
And it's like, and how do you, you know, keep it so that their childhood is their childhood? And that was just kind of always the guiding principle that we used here. It was like looking at how do we balance what we want for them with the world that they're growing up in, right?
Yeah.
And so, yes, that's why I think for me, we were not like a media-free family entirely, but we were very mindful of what was being consumed.
Mm-hmm.
And so lots of people like to do Harry Potter when kids are 7 years old. And I'm here to say, I think it's a disservice to do Harry Potter when they're seven. I think you need to wait for Harry Potter till they're like 11 years old.
Yeah.
And like go more in line with the characters are that age and they're experiencing certain things, right? Like my husband was like, when can we show them Star Wars? And I'm like, you got to wait. Like, just wait. It's going to pay off.
Yes.
And it did, because they were... I think we did Star Wars. I want to say that was like January 2020. Little did we know what was coming.
Yeah.
But it was like one New Year's Eve. He put on one of the Star Wars movies. I don't remember which one it was. Whatever you're supposed to watch first.
Yeah.
And they were old enough and they loved it. And they could relate it to other things. And these big, deep conversations were happening because they were the right age.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really like just, it's such a hard answer to give, like to explain how this went, but it was really just knowing your child and knowing what you want for them and guiding accordingly and being willing to explain why you need to wait, like, and have those conversations. You know, like there was one night where my younger daughter, I think it was like sixth or seventh grade, and her best friend at the time got a cell phone, got her first iPhone, and Emma was just in tears.
Yep.
Because she didn't have that. And now her friend was sucked into the phone. Like they used to hang out at dance in between classes and they chat and they talk and they play and they do whatever. But all of a sudden this girl is just obsessed with her phone. And Emma's like, I just miss my friend. And it broke my heart. And I was like, I understand that. But you're still not getting a phone.
Yeah.
And this is why. And we had this conversation. At the end of it, she felt better. But she, you know, it was still hard. And that's where, like, my husband and I had to do a lot of talking about what is right for her, what is right for us. You know, what do we want for them? How do we want this to go? And it is so hard because there is nothing that our parents can relate to. I mean, I'm sure there are things, but not anything significant like having a computer in your palm all the time. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's, as they've gotten older, it's been a little trickier, but I think because of the way they have grown up, it's allowed them to appreciate things that they might not appreciate otherwise. Like they have, we often get a lot of compliments on how they can connect with all different ages. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that is because they have grown up not just always with their same age peers, yes. but like, you know, with these people and, mm-hmm. and you know, not, we have never allowed phones like when we're out with family or, yeah. you know, like it's just different. And they will, you know, kids are just kids. It's not, they're happy to talk to whoever. So I think a lot of it has been really just seeing who they've become and guiding accordingly and saying to them ad nauseum sometimes, our job, they're like, yes, you tell us all the time. Our job is for when you launch into the world to, you know, be confident and compassionate and caring. Like I said at the beginning, right? Yeah. Like it's mm-hmm. all these things that we want for them is to go into the world and be successful adults.
Yeah.
And our job is to help you learn those skills to get there. Mm-hmm. And you can't learn those skills if your nose is always staring at your phone. So,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, yeah, it's tricky. Yeah. I wish I had like a map to send the two of you, like, this is what you do and yeah, this is how it yeah. works out. But it is yeah. still a little uncharted.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I remember being a middle schooler, just feeling exactly what you described your younger daughter yeah. feeling of, you know, why don't you let me watch the things that my friends are watching? You don't, right? You want me to be disliked, you know, like, yeah. like I'm being teased because I have kale in my lunch, mom. Yeah. Don't you understand? You know, but, yes. Fast forward 6 years later mm-hmm. and everyone's decided that kale is really healthy and everyone eats it all the time, you know,
right?
Like,
yeah.
it just, you know, and I think that is this really interesting thing that I feel like I'm watching play out between parents and children and parents who want to parent differently than their parents did because they felt that maybe there was some suppression of feeling, right? And so now I feel that parents are really leaning into feeling, and yet yeah. so much of that then is avoiding right. conflict. And, you know, I look back to those moments and I'm like, yeah, me as a 12-year-old wanted to throttle my mom and I was convinced that she hated me. And yet by the time I was 20, I could say thank you for those decisions. Yeah. And yeah. like, even at that age, when I was, you know, a different kind of adolescent, right? Still rather adolescent at age 20, but even at that yeah. point, I could say thank you for drawing those boundaries for me because I right. wasn't developmentally ready to do that,
right?
You
no,
know, and no. and I think that one of the real amazing things about homeschooling, in my opinion, is that there is no one to defer those choices on other than you as a parent.
Right.
You know, a right. lot of times yeah. you have like a school that has rules and you're like, oh, thank goodness. Sorry, sweetheart. Your school will not let you wear a bra and no shirt. Like, oh, guess you can't have to wear a shirt to school today.
Yeah.
You know, that
that was never my issue, but yeah.
Exactly. Yes. But, you've got to wear a shirt.
Yeah. But like, I do feel that there is this really interesting thing that happens when yeah. you're homeschooling where it's like
yeah.
you really have to be so intentional
and hold the line
and hold the line, yes. hold all the lines. And I really like, I commend every single parent who takes that on because I think, you know, I mean, I have a 2-year-old, so we're very much not even close to that yet, but
yeah.
But, you know, already it's like, no, buddy, I'm sorry. You've already had 3 bananas today. If I want your digestive tract to work properly, you can't have 5.
Right. I'm sorry. Yes, they're yummy. We love them. But no.
Yeah. And you're yes. going to cry about it and I will hug you and help you through it. But like, we're yeah, not going to have more okay. bananas.
Right.
As we come to the hour about, I was wondering, Shell, if you have any questions for us.
Oh, my word. I don't think so. I think this has just been so wonderful to get to chat with the both of you and, you know, kind of go back and forth. And I could talk to you for so much longer, but I guess I would love to know, and I'm a little bit behind in my podcast listening to, but I would love to know what you both are doing now other than podcasting, since the Waldorf School of Santa Fe has closed, which was so sad to me.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like, yeah. Are you...
Well, yeah, what are we doing,
where is
Matthew?
Where's your life taking you now? Yeah.
Okay, I'll go first, yeah. I guess. Well, so the school shut down 2 weeks before the school was supposed to be opened. And so I was not able to jump into another classroom setting right away. So I essentially took this semester off, and I've been looking at Waldorf Today quite religiously and
yes.
looking at the jobs that come out. And just last week, actually, I interviewed for a high school math science teaching position, and actually another high school admin chair position at the Gathering Waters Charter School in Keene, New Hampshire.
Oh, so, you might be coming out my way.
Yeah, so, I mean, who knows what will happen there, but that is a possibility. And so I'm, you know, I'm still, it's nothing's for sure yet, but it's kind of a question of do I stay in Santa Fe and maybe get some other kind of job or a public teacher's license? But after 18 years, I'm pretty wedded to the Waldorf system school. So yeah, so I'm looking for different jobs and around the country, and it might be the Northeast, or it might be whatever else job pops up on the Waldorf right? Today, you know?
I know. Yeah, there's always such good stuff there. So, well, we'd love to have you here. That'd be amazing. But, you know, good luck.
Thanks.
I also have kind of been taking a break-ish. I've, one of my early jobs at the Santa Fe Waldorf School was teaching Spanish. My undergraduate degree was in Spanish. And so I've been teaching 3 days a week for a small homeschool group that is taught by two retired Waldorf teachers. And so, you know, I pop in, I do some Spanish with 4 fifth graders, and then I leave. I'm writing a novel and I'm
love that.
Yeah. I've completed my first draft, and I'm in the editing process now. And what's really funny is, my editor, one of my editors is, you know, our first guest on the podcast, Zach Caputo, who was one of my dear childhood friends. And he's just the right amount of scary and intimidating to where, you know, he's, you know, telling me the hard stuff that's not always easy to hear. But yeah, so I'm moving through working on this book that I kind of started part time and now I'm really diving into, and also have questions living in my family of whether or not to stay. I think, yeah. You know, with a younger child, there's this idea that maybe there's more time to see what happens. But I really know in my soul that I'm not ready to give up the idea of my son going to a Waldorf school.
Yeah.
And so I think that is, but there's, I also can see on the other hand, a community of young parents here who are in this financial situation to where, you know, a private school is not in their future. And so, you know, maybe entertaining, what would it be like if we all came together to make something for our children? So I think there's a lot of unknowns. We're plant people in my family. So of course, you know, our home has all these trees and we're constantly putting things in the soil. And so there's the idea of moving carries some added weight because it's not just a house. It's,
right.
You know, hours and hours and hours of primarily my husband's blood, sweat, tears, you know, skin cells, just like, I mean, he's really poured a lot into our home. So the question of moving is one we are living with, but if we would move, we would probably go to Wisconsin. He has family in Madison, and we really love the Viroqua community up there.
So nice. Yeah. It'd be one thing if you could just, like, lift the whole house, right?
Yeah,
like,
right?
Not have to pack it. Like, just, okay, we're just going to transport it over here.
Yeah, and we're lucky enough to own our home, you know, and
good,
have
yeah.
land. And so we are in a really magical spot. And so there's...
Yep.
It's a big choice, but
it is.
Yeah.
We are thinking that the podcast would probably continue even if we were all spread out. So
it will survive.
Oh good.
Yeah. I mean that was the main thing of the semester it was a lot of creative endeavors, I think, for both of us.
Yes.
Yeah. So. That's so good. Oh my God. See, it's like, you just never know. Like, you can plan as much as you can plan, but at the end of the day, it's going to play out the way it's going to play out. And there might be just something truly incredible around the next bend that you never would have imagined or been able to do if, you know, you were still working
totally
at the school. It's hard though when you're in it, especially when there are children involved and you're like,
yes,
you know, we got to put food on the table. Like, how are we paying the bills?
Yeah.
Like things like that.
Absolutely.
But, you know, it does all work out. I mean, I left teaching, gosh, eons ago, and, you know, my husband still weeps about the loss of the teacher's retirement, but getting over it,
yeah.
You know, but it's like, you just never know. I had no idea that, you know, life would have gone the way it went. And I'm grateful it did, even for the hard times.
Yeah.
Wish I had a crystal ball to see what the next chapter brings, but first I got to get through this dissertation and then we'll like go from there. But,
I'm particularly enthusiastic about the idea of a public charter Waldorf school.
Yes.
And the alliance and it does seem to fill this need of having people, families who can't afford a private school to education to actually meet that and more.
And I think there can be a tendency when talking about the public charters to focus on what is lost, right? Mm-hmm. And what can't carry over. But I just think about like what is gained by the access and really then, you know, I think that, and I mean, this is just speaking off the cuff, that when there is when you are paying a lot of money, a large percentage of your income for education, there, it really, really is a transaction.
Yes.
And that there is a, you know, almost panicked frenzy around that exchange that comes from just, you know, the understanding of how much someone is giving to be in that place.
Right.
And I think that people sometimes see a large tuition and have an expectation of what they're going to get in exchange, right? Of like, okay, a large tuition means all, you know, here are all of my unspoken assumptions about what that means. And then I look on the flip side of a, you know, a charter, and that then there can be this choice of like, no, I'm here because there's nothing standing in between me and what I want for my children.
Right.
And, you know, I just like, I think of my group of friends who are so embodying, you know, home rhythm, and they're baking with their children. You walk into their home and I feel like this is the spirit of Waldorf education. And these are the people who I would want to be in a Waldorf community. And there's just, and this is not to put aside how much financial aid just about every single Waldorf school provides, right? The private Waldorf schools are going out of their way to try and make it accessible to as many people as possible.
Absolutely.
We have to acknowledge that, but they're still not enough for everyone. And they still rely on tuition to pay teachers and all of these things. And so I think even if there is a compromise in, you know, in elements of the curriculum or in some of the language that is used because there is public funding coming in, that there still is something so powerful to be gained in the fact that the people coming through the door are people who really, really feel strongly about being
there. Absolutely.
And you'd be quite surprised about what compromises there are. It's so individualistic by state from what I've been learning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, New Hampshire, even compared to New Mexico, is surprisingly different. And at least the Gathering Waters Charter School, Public Waldorf Charter School, you know, they were able to create their charter. And basically, I mean, there was some differences, but they didn't, because of the rules regarding how the charter school is set up, what they did in New Hampshire could not be replicated in New Mexico.
Yeah.
And there's like, basically like four things. First of all, in New Mexico, all public I mean, charter schools are public schools, and in a public mm-hmm. Waldorf charter school, you need to have public teacher certifications in addition to your Waldorf education, ideally.
Yeah.
Right.
In New Hampshire, you don't have to have a public teacher's certification. So that school was able to take all the faculty
wow.
basically and just and then move them right over.
Mm.
In addition, yeah. this whole idea of high stakes testing is also very oh. much by state. And what's surprising is that it seems like the states that have Republican governors actually are more liberal in a way around their educational policy than states with Democratic leaning governors and ethos.
That's the case in Wisconsin. You know, in Wisconsin, you have school choice where mm-hmm. families can acquire state funding to pay full tuition for their children to go to a private school. And it's amazing.
Wild. Yeah.
I visited one Waldorf school that had opted in to the state choice and mm-hmm. one who hadn't. Mm-hmm. And guess which school was circling the drain, right? Yeah. Was really, really yeah. struggling.
Hard.
And it was full tuition. It's not a
right.
Like that's yeah. full tuition. And you know, that's a very, it's fascinating. It's really fascinating.
It's hard. Like down here in Massachusetts, the charter schools don't get. So like when my girls were at the charter, Marlboro had to send the charter school money for them, for their education, but it's not the full amount that they charge per pupil in district, right? Like, so they are not as well funded as they could be or should be here in Massachusetts. And so there are some struggles around that where it's like, we're not getting the same per pupil expenditure that the like district public schools have to work with. Which is unfortunate because I think they are a great option for people. It does yeah. give more choice. It does allow students to like find where they might fit better if they don't fit well in their district schools. I'm always about like, it's got to meet the needs of the student, right? Like mm-hmm. everybody needs to work together and not be scared. Oh, there's a charter opening. They're going to like take away from us. They're going to take the kids that are not thriving in your setting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we should want as educators, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I would love to see, like, I know that the Alliance is really, there are more public Waldorf charter schools out there than we realize, but it would be nice if there were even more. One of my EDD cohort colleagues does work at Gathering Waters. Another one who was out in Utah, but she's in the Netherlands, I think. She's in Europe for this school year. And then a good friend of mine recently started sending her children to, what is that, Mountain Song out in Colorado?
Yeah,
Mountain Song, yeah.
You know, and she was like inspired based on the things that I would share on Facebook about Waldorf. And she started to look at it for her children and they chose to send their kids there this year. And it sounds like they're doing great. So like,
yay.
Let's go public charter Waldorf schools. Like, let's do it, you know.
Yeah.
But maybe y'all need to start one like, in all your spare time. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that it takes, you know, it takes the right people with the right enthusiasm and the right humility and yeah. knowledge. It's like that, finding the combination of both. But
totally.
Yeah. Well,
going back to homeschooling, I think if I had to be a homeschool student, I wish you could be my homeschool teacher.
Agree.
Thank you. It is my, you know, it's been the honor of a lifetime to get to take this journey with them. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what they tell their kids when they're older, if they have children, about their, you know, school years and they're growing up. And so I'm excited. It's truly a privilege. So.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you. This has been really amazing.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That concludes another episode of Hard Beeswax. Thanks for listening. Our work would not be possible without the valuable time and effort of Andy Smith, our producer and sound engineer. For episodes and more, please visit our website at hardbeeswax.transistor.fm.